2 days later, with the Ramtops a blue and white wall that was beginning to dominate the Hubwood horizon, the company was attacked. There wasn't much drama. They had just manhandled the Latties across a ford and were resting in the shade of a grove of trees, which suddenly fruited robbers. Howell looked along the line of half a dozen stained and rusty blades. Their owners seemed slightly uncertain about what to do next.
"We've got a receipt somewhere," he began.
Tom John nudged him.
"These don't look like guild thieves,"
he hissed.
"They definitely look freelance to me."
It would be nice to say that the leader of the robbers was a black-bearded, swaggering brute, with a red headscarf and one gold earring and a chin you could clean pots with. Actually, it would be practically compulsory. And, in fact, this was so. Howell thought the wooden leg was overdoing it, but the man had obviously studied the role.
"Well, now," said the bandit chief, "what have we here, and do you have any money?"
"We're actors," said Tom John.
"That ought to answer both questions," said Howell. "And none of your repartee," said the bandit. "I've been to the city, I have. I know repartee when I see it, and—"
He half turned to his followers, raising an eyebrow to indicate that the next remark was going to be witty.
"If you're not careful, I can make a few cutting remarks of my own."
There was dead silence behind him until he made an impatient gesture with his cutlass.
"All right,"
he said, against a chorus of uncertain laughter.
"We'll just take any loose change, valuables, food and clothing you might be having."
"Could I say something?" said Tom John. The company backed away from him. Howell smiled at his own feet.
"You're going to beg for mercy, are you?" said the bandit.
"That's right." Howell thrust his hands deep into his pocket and looked up at the sky, whistling under his breath and trying not to break into a maniac grin. He was aware that the other actors were also looking expectantly at Tom John. "He's going to give them the mercy speech from the Troll's Tale," he thought. "The point I'd just like to make is that," said Tom John. And his stance changed subtly. His voice became deeper, his right hand flung out dramatically.
"The worth of man lies not in feats of arms, or the fiery hunger or the ravening."
It's going to be like when that man tried to rob us back in Stolat, Howell thought. If they end up giving us their swords, what the hell are we going to do with them? And it's so embarrassing when they start crying. It was at this moment that the world around him took a green tint, and he thought he could make out, right on the cusp of hearing, other voices.
"There's men with swords, Granny!
Rend with glowing blades, the marvel of the world," Tom John said.
And the voices at the edge of imagination said,
"No king of mine is going to beg anything off anyone. Give me that milk jug, McGrat."
"The heart of compassion, the kiss.
That was a present from my aunt.
This jewel of jewels, this crown of crowns."
There was silence. One or two of the bandits were weeping silently into their hands. Their chief said,
"Is that it?"
For the first time in his life, Tom John looked nonplussed.
"Well, yes," he said. "Would you like me to repeat it?"
"That was a good speech," the bandit conceded. "But I don't see what it's got to do with me. I'm a practical man. Hand over your valuables."
His sword came up until it was level with Tom John's throat.
"And all the rest of you shouldn't be standing there like idiots," he added. "Come on, or the boy gets it."
Winslow, the apprentice, raised a cautious hand.
"What?"
said the bandit.
Are you sure you listened carefully, sir?"
"I won't tell you again. Either I hear the clink of coins, or you hear a gurgle."
In fact, what they all heard was a whistling noise high in the air, and the crash as a milk jug, its sides frosted with the ice of altitude, dropped out of the sky onto the spike atop of the chief's helmet. The remaining bandits took one look at the results and fled. The actors stared down at the recumbent bandit. Howell prodded a lump of frozen milk with his boot.
"Well, well," he said weakly.
"He didn't take any notice," whispered Tom John.
"A born critic," said the dwarf.
It was a blue and white jug. Funny how little detail stood out at a time like this. It had been smashed several times in the past, he could see, because the pieces had been carefully glued together again. Someone had really loved that jug.
"What we're dealing with here," he said, rallying some shreds of logic, "is a freak whirlwind, obviously."
"But milk jugs don't just drop out of the sky," said Tom John, demonstrating the astonishing human art of denying the obvious.
"I don't know about that. I've heard of fish and frogs and rocks," said Howell. "There's nothing against crockery."
He began to rally.
"It's just one of these uncommon phenomenas. They happen all the time in this part of the world. There's nothing unusual about it."
They got back onto the carts and rode on in unaccustomed silence. Young Wimslow collected every bit of jug he could find and stored them carefully in the props box, and spent the rest of the day watching the sky, hoping for a sugar basin. The Latties toiled up the dusty slopes of the Ramtops, mere motes in the foggy glass of the crystal.
"Are they all right?" said McGrath.
"They're wandering all over the place," said Granny. "They might be good at acting, but they've got something to learn about the travelling."
"It was a nice jug," said McGrath. "You can't get them like that any more. I mean, if you'd said what was on your mind, there was a flat iron on the shelf."
"There's more to life than milk jugs."
"It had a daisy pattern round the top." Granny ignored her.
"I think," she said, "it's time we had a look at this new king close up."
She cackled. "You cackled, Granny," said McGrath darkly.
"I did not. It was..."
Granny fumbled for a word.
"A chuckle."
"I bet Black Alice used to cackle."
"You want to watch out. You don't end up the same way as she did," said Nanny, from her seat by the fire. "She went a bit funny at the finish, you know. Poisoned apples and such like." "Just because I might have chuckled a bit roughly," sniffed Granny.
She felt she was being unduly defensive.
"Anyway, there's nothing wrong with cackling. In moderation."
"I think," said Tom John, "that we're lost."
Howell looked at the baking purple moorland around them, which stretched up to the towering spires of the Ramtops themselves. Even in the height of summer, there were pennants of snow flying from the highest peaks. It was a landscape of describable beauty. Bees were busy, or at least endeavouring to look and sound busy, in the thyme by the trackside. Cloud shadows flickered over the alpine meadows. There was the kind of big, empty silence made by an environment that not only doesn't have people in it, but doesn't need them either. Or signposts.
"We were lost 10 miles ago," said Howell. "There's got to be a new word for what we are now."
"You said the mountains were honeycombed with dwarf mines," said Tom John. "You said a dwarf could tell wherever he was in the mountains."
"Underground," I said. "It's all a matter of strata and rock formations, not on the surface. All the landscape gets in the way."
"We could dig you a hole," said Tom John.
But it was a nice day, and as the road meandered through clumps of hemlock and pine, outposts of the forest, it was pleasant enough to let the mules go at their own pace. The road, Howell felt, had to go somewhere. This geographical fiction had been the death of many people. Roads don't necessarily have to go anywhere. They just have to have somewhere to start.
"We are last, aren't we?" said Tom John after a while.
"Certainly not."
"Where are we, then?"
"Mountains, perfectly clear on any atlas."
"We ought to stop and ask someone."
Tom John gazed around at the rolling countryside. Somewhere a lonely curlew howled, or possibly it was a badger. Hull was a little lazy about rural matters, at least those that took place higher than about the limestone layer. There wasn't another human being within miles.
"Who did you have in mind?"
he said sarcastically.
"That old woman in the funny hat?" said Tom John, pointing. "I've been watching her. She keeps ducking behind a bush when she thinks I've seen her."
Howell turned and looked at the bramble bush, which wobbled.
"Ho there, good mother," he said.
The bush sprouted an indignant head.
"Whose mother?" it said.
Howell hesitated.
"Just a figure of speech, Mrs. Miss...
Mistress," snapped Granny Weatherwax.
"And I'm a poor old woman gathering wood," she added defiantly.
She cleared her throat.
"Lawks," she went on, "you did give me a fright, young master. My poor old heart."
There was silence from the cart. Then Tom John said, "I'm sorry."
"What?"
said Granny.
"Your poor old heart what?"
"What about my poor old heart?"
said Granny, who wasn't used to acting like an old woman and had a very limited repertoire in this area. But it's traditional that young heirs seeking their destiny get help from mysterious old women gathering wood, and she wasn't about to buck tradition.
"It's just you mentioned it," said Howell.
"Well, it isn't important. Lawks, I expect you're looking for Lonkra,"
said Granny testily, in a hurry to get to the point.
"Well, yes," said Tom John, "all day."
"You've come too far," said Granny. "Go back about 2 miles, and take the track on the right, past the stand of pines."
Wimslow tugged at Tom John's shirt.
"When you meet a mysterious old lady on the road," he said, "you've got to offer her a share of your lunch, or help her across the river."
"You have?"
"It's terribly bad luck not to."
Tom John gave Granny a polite smile.
"Would you care to share our lunch, good Mom?
Granny looked doubtful.
"What is it?"
"Salt pork?"
She shook her head.
"Thanks all the same," she said graciously, "but it gives me wind."
She turned on her heel and set off through the bushes.
"We could help you across the river if you like,"
shouted Tom John after her.
"What river?"
said Howell.
"We're on the moor. There can't be a river in miles."
"You've got to get them on your side," said Wimslow. "Then they help you."
"Perhaps we should have asked her to wait while we went and looked for one,"
said Howell sourly. They found the turning. It led to a forest crisscrossed with as many tracks as a marshalling yard. The sort of forest where the back of your head tells you the trees are turning around to watch you as you go past, and the sky seems to be very high up and a long way off. Despite the heat of the day, a dank, impenetrable gloom hovered among the tree trunks, which crowded up to the track as if intending to obliterate it completely. They were soon lost again, and decided that being lost somewhere where you didn't know where you were was even worse than being lost in the open.
"She could have given more explicit instructions,"
said Howell.
"Like, ask at the next crone,"
said Tom John.
"Look over there."
He stood up in the seat.
"Ho there, old good,"
he hazarded. McGrath pushed back her shawl.
Just a humble wood-gatherer,
she snapped. She held up a twig for proof. Several hours waiting with nothing but trees to talk to hadn't improved her temper. Wimslow nudged Tom John, who nodded and fixed his face in an ingratiating smile.
Would you care to share our lunch, old good miss?
He said.
It's only salt pork, I'm afraid.
Meat is extremely bad for the digestive system, said McGrath. If you could see inside your colon, you'd be horrified.
I think I would, muttered Howell.
Did you know that an adult male carries up to 5 pounds of undigested red meat in his intestines at all times? Said McGrath, whose informative lectures on nutrition had been known to cause whole families to hide in the cellar until she went away, whereas pine kernels and sunflower seeds...
There aren't any rivers around here that you need helping over, are there?
Said Tom John desperately.
Don't be silly, said McGrath. I'm just a humble wood-gatherer, Lorks, collecting a few sticks and mayhap directing lost travellers on the road to Loncra.
Ah, said Howell. I thought we'd get to that.
You fork left up ahead and turn right at the big stone with the crack in it. You can't miss it, said McGrath.
Fine, growled Howell. Well, we won't keep you. I'm sure you've got a lot of wood to collect and so forth.
He whistled the mules into a plod again, grumbling to himself. When, an hour later, the track ran out among a landscape of house-sized boulders, Howell laid down the reins carefully and folded his arms. Tom John stared at him.
"What do you think you're doing?"
he said.
"Waiting,"
said the dwarf grimly.
"It'll be getting dark soon."
"We won't be here long,"
said Howell. Eventually, Nanny Og gave up and came out from behind her rock.
"It's salt pork, understand?"
said Howell sharply.
"Take it or leave it, okay? Now, which way's Loncra?"
"Keep on left at the ravine. Then you pick up the track that leads to a bridge. You can't miss it," said Nanny promptly.
Howell grabbed the reins.
"You forgot about the Lorks."
"Bagger! Sorry, Lorks!"
"And you're a humble old wood-gatherer, I expect,"
Howell went on.
"Spot on, lad," said Nanny cheerfully. "Just about to make a start, as a matter of fact."
Tom John nudged the dwarf.
"You forgot about the river," he said.
Howell glared at him.
"Oh, yes,"
he muttered.
"And you can wait here while we go and find a river."
"To help you across," said Tom John carefully.
Nanny Og gave him a bright smile.
"There's a perfectly good bridge," she said. "But I wouldn't say no to a lift. Move over."
To Howell's irritation, Nanny Og hitched up her skirts and scrambled onto the board, inserting herself between Tom John and the dwarf, and then twisting like an oyster knife until she occupied half the seat.
"You mentioned salt pork," she said. "There wouldn't be any mustard, would there?"
"No,"
said Howell sullenly.
"Can't abide salt pork without condiments," said Nanny conversationally. "But pass it over anyway."
Wimslow wordlessly handed over the basket holding the troop's supper. Nanny lifted the lid and gave it a critical assessment.
"That cheese in there's a bit off," she said. "Needs eating up quick. What's in the leather bottle?"
"Beer,"
said Tom John, a fraction of a second before Howell had the presence of mind to say,
"Walter."
"Pretty weak stuff," said Nanny eventually.
She fumbled in her apron pocket for her tobacco pouch.
"Has anyone got a light?"
she inquired. A couple of actors produced bundles of matches. Nanny nodded and put the pouch away.
"Good," she said. "Now, has anyone got any tobacco?"
Half an hour later, the Latties rolled over the Loncra Bridge, across some of the outlying farmlands, and through the forest that made up most of the kingdom.
"This is it?"
said Tom John.
Well, not all of it, said Nanny, who had been expecting rather more enthusiasm. There's lots more of it behind the mountains over there, but this is the flat bit.
You call this flat?
Flattish, Nanny conceded, but the air's good. That's the palace up there, offering outstanding views of the surrounding countryside.
You mean forests?
You'll like it here, said Nanny encouragingly.
It's a bit small. Nanny thought about this. She'd spent nearly all her life inside the boundaries of Lancre. It had always seemed about the right size to her.
Bijou, she said, handy for everywhere.
Everywhere where?
Nanny gave up.
Everywhere close, she said.
Howell said nothing. The air was good. Rolling down the unclimbable slopes of the ramtops like a sinus wash, tinted with turpentine from the high forests. They passed through a gateway into what was, up here, probably called a town. The cosmopolitan he had become decided that, down on the plains, it would just about have qualified as an open space.
"There's an inn,"
said Tom John doubtfully. Howell followed his gaze.
"Yes,"
he said eventually.
"Yes, it probably is."
"When are we going to do the play?"
"I don't know. I think we just send up to the castle and say we're here."
Howell scratched his chin.
"Fool said the king, or whatever, would want to see the script."
Tom John looked around Lancre Town. It seemed peaceful enough. It didn't look like the kind of place likely to turn actors out at nightfall. It needed the population.
"This is the capital city of the kingdom," said Nanny Ogg. "Well-designed streets, you'll notice."
"Streets?" said Tom John.
"Street," corrected Nanny. "Also, houses in quite good repair. Stone's throw from river."
"Throw?"
"Drop," Nanny conceded. "Neat middens, look, and extensive."
"Madam, we've come to entertain the town, not buy it," said Howell.
Nanny Ogg looked sidelong at Tom John.
"Just wanted you to see how attractive it is," she said.
"Your civic pride does you credit," said Howell. "And now please leave the cart. I'm sure you've got some wood to gather. Lawks."
"Much obliged for the snack," said Nanny, climbing down.
"Meals,"
corrected Howell. Tom John nudged him.
"You ought to be more polite," he said. "You never know."
He turned to Nanny.
"Thank you, good—"
Oh, she's gone.
"They've come to do a theatre," said Nanny.
Granny Weatherwax carried on shelling beans in the sun, much to Nanny's annoyance.
"Well, aren't you going to say something? I've been finding out things," she said. "Picking up information, not sitting around making soup.
Stew."
"I reckon it's very important," sniffed Nanny.
"What kind of a theatre?"
"They didn't say. Something for the Duke, I think."
"What's he want a theatre for?"
"They didn't say that either."
"It's probably all a trick to get in the castle," Granny said knowingly. "Very clever idea. Did you see anything in the carts?"
"Boxes and bundles and such."
"They'll be full of armour and weapons, depend upon it."
Nanny Ogg looked doubtful.
"They didn't look very much like soldiers to me. They were awfully young and spotty."
"Clever. I expect in the middle of the play the king will manifest his destiny, right where everyone can see him. Good plan."
"There's another thing," said Nanny, picking up a bean pod and chewing it. "He doesn't seem to like the place much."
"Of course he does. It's in his blood." I brought him the pretty way. He doesn't seem very impressed.
Granny hesitated.
He was probably suspicious of you, she concluded. He was probably too overcome to speak, really.
She put down the bowl of beans and looked thoughtfully at the trees.
Have you got any family still working up at the castle?
She said.
Shirl and Daff help out in the kitchen since the cook went off his head. Good. I'll have a word with McGrat. I think we should see this theatre.
Perfect, said the Duke.
Thank you, said Howell.
You've got it exactly spot on about that dreadful accident, said the Duke. You might almost have been there.
You weren't, were you?
Said Lady Felmet, leaning forward and glaring at the dwarf.
I just used my imagination,
said Howell hurriedly. The Duchess glared at him, suggesting that his imagination could consider itself lucky it wasn't being dragged off to the courtyard to explain itself to four angry wild horses in a length of chain.
Exactly right,
said the Duke, leafing one-handedly through the pages.
This is exactly, exactly, exactly how it was.
Will have been,
snapped the Duchess. The Duke turned another page.
You're in this too, he said. Amazing. It's word for word how I'm going to remember it. I see you got death in it too.
Always popular, said Howell. People expect it.
How soon can you act it?
Stage it, corrected Howell, and added, we've tried it out. As soon as you like.
And then we can get away from here, he said to himself. Away from your eyes like two raw eggs, and this female mountain in the red dress, and this castle which seems to act like a magnet for the wind. This is not going to go down as one of my best plays, I know that much.
How much did you say we were going to pay you?
Said the Duchess.
I think you mentioned another 100 silver pieces, said Howell.
Worth every penny, said the Duke.
Howell left hurriedly before the Duchess could start to bargain, but he felt he'd gladly pay something to be out of this place. Bijou, he thought. Gods, how could anyone like a kingdom like this? The fool waited in the meadow with the lake. He stared wistfully at the sky and wondered where the hell McGrat was. This was, she said, their place. The fact that a few dozen cows also shared it at the moment didn't appear to make any difference. She turned up in a green dress and a filthy temper.
"What's all this about a play?" she said.
The fool sagged onto a willow log.
"Aren't you glad to see me?"
he said.
"Well, yes, of course. Now, this play."
"My lord wants something to convince people that he is the rightful king of Lancre. Himself, mostly, I think."
"Is that why you went to the city?"
"Yes."
"It's disgusting!"
The fool sat calmly. "Would you prefer the Duchess's approach?" he said. "She thinks they ought to kill everyone. She's good at that sort of thing. And then there'd be fighting and everything. Lots of people would die anyway. This way might be easier."
"Oh, where's your spunk, man?"
"Pardon?"
"Don't you want to die nobly for a just cause?"
"I'd much rather live quietly, for one." "It's all right for you witches. You can do what you like, but I'm circumscribed," said the fool. McGrat sat down beside him.
"Find out all about this play," Granny had ordered. "Go and talk to that jingling friend of yours,"
she'd replied. "He's very loyal. He might not tell me anything." And Granny had said,
"This is no time for half measures. If you have to, seduct him."